Well, the audience is coming to the microphones for questions. I'll start with a couple questions. I imagine a future where people can go to a stool bank, just like they now go to a sperm bank and choose out certain qualities. My question is, do you have a specific program that you use to screen the donors, and how do you select donors, and what are some of the exclusion criteria for donorship?
Definitely. Great question. So I can tell you that when I was screening my own donors in my initial iteration of my program, the main things you have to look for is really that the patient can't have, or the donor can't have any GI illness themselves, so no IBD, chronic constipation. They really have to have normal daily formed bowel movements. They can't have taken antibiotics within the last 3 months. And then we really look for those microbiome-associated diseases, so no obesity, metabolic syndrome, really any autoimmune diseases. I can tell you what Open Biome does now, which is the stool bank I use currently. They screen for literally everything. They have a less than 3% pass rate of for stool donors, so it's extremely difficult to become a stool donor with how rigorous the criteria is. We've looked across sort of all, many donor characteristics, including gender, diet, their actual microbiome profile, metabolite profile. We know that it doesn't matter in terms of efficacy for C. diff. I think the interesting thing is when we get into chronic diseases. So right now I'm doing several clinical trials for inflammatory bowel disease. We're doing one for obesity and other autoimmune diseases. That's where donor selection becomes much more interesting, and you might have to really start to whittle down very specific donor characteristics. We still do not really know who the ideal donor is for, and each disease it's going to be different. So that area is a lot of study still ongoing.
Great, thank you. I'll take the first question from this microphone.
Yes, Sid Hollick from Venice, Florida. 6 years ago, my wife had a diverticular resection for abscess and post-op developed severe C. diff colitis. Became hypotensive, survived. I just wonder if there's, if y'all have seen this in a post-resection where you have a fresh anastomosis. Second case is I had a lady who had severe C. diff for after a hysterectomy, one dose cephalosporin. And 6 months later, she came with a diverticular abscess. We treated her with full antibiotics and did a resection and post-op antibiotics, and she never had a flare-up. So just two cases, and I wonder if you could just comment on any experience with that.
Sure. So there have been incidences and some reports of C. diff infection proliferating after, especially after the reconnection of defunctionalized bowel. So I don't know if that patient had a Hartman's procedure and then got reconnected and then the C. diff proliferated after that. But certainly if a patient's colon is colonized with C. diff and then subsequently refunctionalized with the burden of stool and nutrients that the C. diff sees, it can proliferate. And so we have seen incidences of that.
Okay, a question at this microphone.
Okay. I'm Doak Doolittle from Cameron, Missouri. About 4 years ago, our community had somewhat of an outbreak of C. diff with the diarrhea. I mean, it wasn't getting to fulminant disease, but we're having recurrences after medical treatment and so forth. This was both community acquired and hospital acquired. We did quite a few fecal transplants under our protocol. Our director of nursing was the donor, and she was fully tested. And then all of a sudden, our hospital said we can no longer do them because there was no reimbursement.
So is your question, how do they get reimbursed?
Well, no, I'm just saying, what do you people do about it?
So this is a great question. This came up a lot in the earlier days of FMT, and I can tell you it's really a state-by-state problem. So in Massachusetts, I can tell you right now, and I think that is fairly across the board as of 2018, most insurance companies will reimburse for the colonoscopy aspect, but they do not reimburse, again, for the donor stool.
Okay.
So if you are doing the screening of your own material, either the donor's insurance has to pay for that testing. I ended up initially working out a deal with billing where we tested them under the same way you would test like a kidney donor recipient, and where it got bundled under the patient's insurance. That seemed to work. However, now when you use, say, if you were to use Open Biome, it costs about $500 for one of those 250 ml bottles. And so again, either your hospital has to eat that cost, the patient has to come in with cash in hand. That is sort of the era we're still living in. We have petitioned for CPT codes for donor stool. We have not heard a response on that yet, but again, that does remain one of the interesting challenges. But the colonoscopy is reimbursed.
I'm just curious.
That's a good idea, because we were giving it by NG tube.
And, yeah, so that is a that so we, is difficult.
It'll reimburse for
and
colonoscopy.
Same with capsules. If you're doing capsules, which I do quite a bit of, you can't your time, you can't get reimbursed for that. I mean, unless you bill it as a clinic visit.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
I'm just curious, by a show of hands, how many people are actually doing the fecal transplants at their institution? So a few, and so do you have a lab that does it, or you get all of yours from this external resource?
So again, I mainly use Open Biome now, which again is available to everyone. So you can literally order it online. They will ship it to you frozen. You do have to have a minus 80 or a minus 20 freezer to put it in. And so that can often be an interesting negotiation where you're going to put poop in the hospital. Some pharmacies I've worked with, like, they just don't want it down there. So you have to either keep it in the OR or an endoscopy. If you are going to use your own institution, you have to really have a discussion with your micro lab, because remember, this is formed stool, and you need to test it for pathogens like C. diff. You need to do a stool culture on it, and you know, typically the micro lab would reject formed stool for those testing. So this is a big undertaking if you're going to do this in your own hospital. So I find, for peace of mind and sake of ease, you know, using Open Biome has been much easier. But again, the cost is something you have to discuss with your hospital.
Okay, a question at this back microphone.
Yes, David Smale, Beverly, Mass. It's been 4 or 5 years since I last did a colectomy for fulminant C. diff, but it sounds like next time I should be doing a loop ileostomy and maybe a fecal transplant down that afferent limb of the loop.
Yeah, certainly. We're seeing more and more that patients with loop ileostomy creation for fulminant C. diff infection, subsequently after loop ileostomy reversal, will develop recurrence of C. diff. And so that is what we have done in a handful of patients, is provide fecal transplantation prior to reversal. Now, that's something that obviously needs to be discussed with your gastroenterologist who does the fecal transplantation at your hospital, as well as the infectious disease doctors, to decide if a patient's a candidate. But that is certainly something that has been done, especially at our institution.
I think since the outbreak of severe toxin-forming C. diff in early 2000s, we have learned the danger of late diagnosis of C. diff, so our degree of suspicion has been heightened. We also have much better diagnostic modalities this day, and we treat patients very aggressively with conventional therapies such as vancomycin, rifaximin, and mitronidazole. But I think that our understanding that those patients who appear ill while having a diarrhea need to be aggressively treated also helped to prevent us from needing to do colectomies or other major interventions.
Dr. Hong, I wondered if you could expand a little bit on just the technical details of how you do this loop ileostomy and the colonic lavage. What do you sort of, how do you do it? How long does it take to get all that pegged through the colon? Can you explain that in more detail?
Certainly. So usually this happens at 2-3 in the morning, and you don't have the supplies that you need, but I've approached this laparoscopically, and you stick a scope in and observe the colon and make sure that the colon's viable. And if it is, then you pull up a loop of the terminal ileum. You try to stay close to the ileocecal valve, because you will pass a Foley catheter, and the hopes is that Foley catheter will pass past the valve into the cecum, and then you instill PEG solution, and it's 8 liters of PEG solution, and so that could take hours sometimes. You place a rectal tube in a patient, and you collect the effluent, and then that Foley catheter stays in place, and you then lavage it with vancomycin postoperatively. And that there's a lot of teaching that has to happen, especially with the ICU nurses who will be administering the vancomycin through the Foley catheter. And if it ever dislodges, to make sure that you've actually placed the Foley catheter back into the efferent limb. So.
Okay, I have another question. The current recommendations for management of patients with inflammatory bowel disease is whenever they get admitted to the hospital with a colitis flare, they should be tested for C. diff. You want to expand a little bit more on, should we, is there any other time we should be testing for C. diff, or do you want to talk about that a little bit
more? Great question. That patient population is a particular interest of mine. I am an IBD doctor by training, and these patients can be extremely difficult to manage because the symptoms of C. diff and an IBD flare are very similar. And so I think the biggest takeaway point, especially when you're dealing with IBD patients, is understand what testing you're looking at. And so we heard all about sort of the issues with testing. I can tell you at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, we actually don't use PCR testing at all anymore because of the likelihood of picking up colonization and not actual infection. And so the European guidelines, the Eschmidt guidelines came out last year that did recommend the two-step method, which we just heard about. So we use, you can use PCR or GDH, the glutamate dehydrogenase test, and you always want to reflex that to toxin, especially in an IBD patient where you cannot rely on the symptoms. And so if they're truly toxin positive, then we, of course we treat. I think one of the biggest mistakes that often happen with IBD patients is the reflex to hold all their immune suppression. We actually know that the C. diff is likely revving up their underlying IBD as well. And so after about 48 hours of treatment, we will continue and even escalate immune suppression. So that's, I would say, one of the biggest things I see in practice. But if they're only PCR positive and toxin negative, I actually do not treat these patients. I will treat them exclusively for their IBD flare.
Okay. A question at the back microphone.
Joe Sfera from Toledo. Getting at this issue of inappropriately positive PCRs, we've noticed in our hospital higher than expected amounts of C. diff. So our infectious disease department has made some recommendations that we stop testing some patients, such as any patient who's on a cathartic, even considered a colase. If they're on colase, we should not test at all for C. diff. If they're on tube feeds, we should not test for C. diff. It's got us pretty stirred up, so can you comment on that?
So, I agree with you completely. I think that we have overreacted in our attempt to early diagnose C. diff, and the test that we're using is overly sensitive. But as I mentioned in my presentation, I think it's important to do a clinical correlation, and Dr. Allegretti pointed out that there are times when you have a patient with diarrhea due to other causes such as C. diff, then you can actually do the reflex testing or sequential testing with ELISA to confirm that in fact you detected the genes, which is what the PCR detects, but you also need to detect a product of the C. difficile, which is toxins. And one argument that our hospital infectious control officers make is that testing asymptomatic patient is for the carrier status. Those patients can be preemptively isolated, or the infection control measures such as gowns and gloves can be implemented in those patients. They find it as a cost-effective ways of managing it. So this, it's not all negative or positive, so there could be benefit for a screening program if it's carefully and thoughtfully implemented.
So I want to leave with sort of one last question. When do you decide to do the loop ileostomy? I mean, you gave us all the data, but so practically speaking, how do you decide? When they call you, you know, the consult from the medicine service, and they say, we've got a patient with C. diff, you know, what's your trigger for saying, I'm going to do the loop ileostomy, or I'm going to do the colectomy, or I'm going to continue medication?
And that's a really good question, and I think that's a question that we're all still trying to answer. I think personally for myself, if I'm seeing a patient and they're extremely sick, they're in the ICU, they're on pressors, they're mechanically ventilated, and the mortality, the risk of doing a colectomy on them with the mortality rate is so high, you know, in trying to minimize the amount of what you do for the patient, then for those patients, I would perform a loop ileostomy and attempt a colonic lavage. And sometimes with these patients, you can also add FMT a few days after if they're not responsive to colonic lavage. But again, these are all just case reports, individual case reports, institutional case reports. And so I think there's just a big black hole in this area that's a very good question that needs to be answered for sure. Yeah.
Dr. Umansky?
I think initial enthusiasm about the loop ileostomy has cooled off a bit. There was a time when we have seen a number of patients who we initially were asked to see, which already have been on couple pressors and hypotensive. There is a narrow therapeutic window for colectomy between the patient who still has severe diarrhea but does not exhibit signs of systemic illness and cardiovascular compromise, and then within several hours they can progress to pressor requirements. And so if you see a patient who is very ill, who unfortunately, and this is common in those patients who have been, who is a transplant patient on immunosuppression, there's a lot of confounding factors, and you realize that with all of this that's going on, they may not be able to tolerate a big operation. This is a very rare subset of patients that may benefit from loop ileostomy. But as I mentioned, our ability to recognize those signs and symptoms and warning signs of patients decompensating early, and that goes along to our medical colleagues in gastroenterology, we now much better in catching the patients within the therapeutic window where we can treat them or we can intervene with a colectomy before they get too ill to be operated on.
Any other comments? All right, well, I thank the panel for those excellent talks, and thank you, audience, for your attention, and we'll conclude this session.